I'm very pleased, if also rather apologetic, to be making this belated introduction to you all of Roger Kennedy, who many of you will already know, is a psychoanalyst,
of course,
a child and adolescent psychiatrist, also a former president of the British Psychoanalytical Society. He's also the author of numerous books and articles, including a joint introductory book on Jacques Lacan, which, when he wrote it, and even now really, is a very interesting foray for an analyst in the British tradition and the British society, but characteristic of the expansiveness and generosity of Roger's interests. A book on child abuse, and titles including The Elusive Human Subject, Psychoanalysis, History and Subjectivity, The Many Voices of Psychoanalysis, and a collection of rather fascinating clinical short stories, fictional short stories, but undoubtedly rooted in his clinical experience, called Couch Tales. His latest book is called The Psychic Home, Psychoanalysis, Consciousness, and the Human Soul, which is, of course, the subject of the evening's talk and discussion. And in a moment, Roger is going to talk for 20 minutes or so and introduce the book. We'll then discuss between the two of us for 15 or 20 minutes, which should leave us 15 or 20 minutes for audience questions and discussion. So, just a word or two. I'm sorry to prolong the delay further. But Roger will outline something of the content of this rich, of this rich and variegated content of the book. So I wanted to just say a couple of words about the implicit picture of the spirit, or even, if we can dare to use the word, the soul of psychoanalysis. Roger's voice, which is a word that he uses a lot in the book, is very far from the fantastical pop caricature of the analyst as hectoring, self-certain and dogmatic. It is, in tone and in its orientation, open, generous, expansive and above all curious about different spheres of human thought and practice, about different regions of knowledge, about difference itself in identity, in values, in ideas, and in personal styles of expression. One of the refreshing things about Roger as a writer, and I think as a person, is that he has a very distinctive personal style. You even have the impression, the radical impression for analysis, that he has a sense of humour. On the other hand, for all its range of interest, it is not a woolly or diffuse style or voice, but quite clear and specific in its aim, in its own distinct and consistent points of reference, and in its sense of its own historical lineage, its rooting, its very distinctive rooting in the ideas and the spirit of the British independent tradition. In this and other books, he covers religion and neuroscience. He covers poetry and social deprivation. He covers philosophy and the state of social institutions. His historical and intellectual range is always adventurous and unpredictable. I think, in other words, that what Roger says about identity in this book, that it's at once plural, variegated and shared or intersubjective, and singular, irreducible, inimitable, is performed by his writing and by himself. And I'm going to stop now and listen to less of that for you. Roger.
Thank you very much. I'm overwhelmed by the introduction. If I can live up to this, thank you very much.
Yeah, it wasn't going to be that effusive, but I thought since I was late.
Fair dues. home is one of those simple yet elemental words that convey powerful feelings of belonging and yearning. Having a home implies both having a physical entity, the physical structure of the dwelling, the house, but also something that goes beyond the building blocks into the area of the interior of the soul, or touching what I suggest is the psychic home. Having an idea of home is just as vital for a person as having a physical shelter. It is one of the most basic human needs. We need to feel at home in the world. It makes us feel secure. It provides the base from which we can explore. The loss of a sense of home is deeply traumatic, as is, of course, the loss of a house. There seems to be a bit of echo. Yet we need to leave home in order to find ourselves, in order to mature and have a firm sense of identity. If exiled, we may be able to carry the sense of home with us. Yet there is often a poignant yearning for the original home. This may be conveyed by that sense of one's physical presence being in one country, but one's soul in another. The sense of home is so basic that we can take it for granted unless the continuity provided by a stable home is undermined. I often see the way that a lack of a clear home can drastically affect a child's stability while doing assessments for social services and the courts. Children often have to be placed in foster care when their own family has become unsafe. While they may settle well into the foster placement, it is rare not to see how confused and troubled the child becomes, if only beneath the surface, until a final decision is made about their future. Some young children in these circumstances will draw two houses with little connection. Others may be unable to represent the confusion symbolically and just remain confused and behaviorally challenging. Yet the notion of an interior space and of a domestic private space within the home has a particular history, which provides the backdrop for the developing notion of the individual's interior or inner world. Thus, the 19th century was the site of crucial developments in a domestic interior, led by changes in the English home, which were a reaction to the storms of the French Revolution and the radical shifts between the public and private realms. During the French Revolution, boundaries between public and private became unstable. An absence of boundaries between individuals was assumed to be the condition of public life. At the same time, the revolution organized, in theory at least, individual rights, recognized individual rights. As a reaction to the turmoil in France, English domestic life turned inwards, establishing the sweet delights of home, where home became a place of tranquility away from stress and strife. Coincidentally, the Romantic movement encouraged a withdrawal into the self and the withdrawal of the family into a more clearly defined domestic space. This can be seen in the pattern of William and Dorothy Wordsworth's life, as I describe in the book. I discuss one of the most persistent themes in Wordsworth's poetry, particularly in his early work, and during the years he wrote his greatest poetry, between about 1795 and 1805, that of home. He writes of yearnings for home, loss of home, about intense homecomings, homes that are ruined and may become a shelter for the homeless, characters who have lost homes or who are homeless. Coincidentally, his life began to change significantly when in 1794 he and his sister Dorothy set up home together for a few weeks, sealing their coming together after years apart, with her having led a life of drudgery in other people's homes and he having led an itinerant life in England and France after the death of their parents when they were young. It was not long before they were living in a permanent home, eventually settling back into the Lake District, their childhood home. And Wordsworth then wrote his most intense poetry, including Tintern Abbey and the early versions of The Prelude. I use Wordsworth's finding of a secure home after his years of wandering to illustrate the concept of a psychic home. He much emphasized the loving attachment to home, and talks about the living soul, the spirit of life, which depends upon the mysterious joining up of old and new through a loving attachment to home. I propose that the notion of a psychic home consists of a number of different and interacting elements, including the physical interior of a home, but internalized in the person as a psychic interior. The notion of personal identity refers to the development and then maintenance of a person's character, how they put together in some way the various multiple identifications, as well as including wider issues concerning a person's cultural and social influence. Suggests that the basic elements of the psychic home can be seen to provide a way of organizing the person's identity, or can be seen as intrinsic to any notion of identity. Identity is a term used in many different ways and by a variety of disciplines. It has become a central issue of concern in contemporary debates about politics, ethics, and culture. Issues of identity also touch upon the soul territory, that of each person's unique sense of who they are. Appiah even goes as far as to call soul-making the project of intervening in the process of interpretation through which each citizen develops an identity. I propose that one of the constant elements is that of the psychic home, and this provides a basis for a sense of identity, for crucial questions such as who am I? Who do I look and act like? Which religion and nationality am I? The indicator search for a place in life, an identity which provides a relatively stable sense of home and that provides the core of the elusive and precarious notion of identity. Like their patients, psychoanalysts carry their psychic home with them, though it will manifest itself differently. The analyst may not reveal details of their private life to their patients, but they carry their psychic home with them into the session. Their choice of interior design of the consulting room, not to mention the books and any objects, reflects the nature of the analyst's psychic home. There is an interaction, that is, between the subjectivity of the analyst and the interior space where they work. An alive psychic home can provide a sustaining space for the analyst, allowing them to cope with the inevitable. The interior of Freud's consulting room, which I had hoped to kind of convey a bit more concretely, was thus not a passive context for analysis, but actively participated in it. So, much of the book develops from a number of different viewpoints of the significance of home in our lives, with the notion of a psychic home as a vital psychic structure which gathers together a number of different human functions. Along the way, I also questioned what we mean by the powerfully evocative notion of the human soul, which has important links to the notion of home. Indeed, I suggest that what makes us human is that we can allow a home for the soul. The word soul seems to be both abstract and yet also powerfully emotive. It can be approached from a number of different angles, from philosophy, religion, sociology, literature, and neuroscience. No one discipline has the monopoly on understanding the soul concept. I explore in the book how the word soul and similar key words such as spirit and inwardness express so much that is essential for humans, even if we cannot be too precise about their meanings. The meanings, in a way, spread over the different words in some ways. While not undertaking an encyclopedic history of the soul concept, I emphasize in the book three crucial moments in the history of the soul. I was trying to make sense of the whole complex subject. One, Plato's foundational picture of the soul in his metaphor of a cave, in addition to his tripartite division of the soul, linking up the soul with both the pursuit of knowledge and an ethical pursuit of the good. What's the good life? You know, Socrates, the good life. That's number one, Plato's foundational picture. Two, subsequently, the place of the soul in Hellenistic and then Christian thought, and its then linking with spiritual transformation. So one has the transformation of the soul. And thirdly, and lastly, the gradual disconnection of the soul from spiritual transformation with the scientific revolution, the development of a mercantile culture and the thought of Descartes. The latter, what Foucault called for convenience the Cartesian moment, has had profound effects on how we picture the soul. Until that point, philosophy and spiritual transformation, knowledge and human value tended to be linked. From then on, there developed a radical split between knowledge and spiritual transformation, between the world of the spirit and the material world, a split which I have suggested needs some sort of attention in our overly materialistic society. Taking our cue from Plato, one can say that the soul is the image of convergence. It is what coheres. It is our name for what makes for the sense of inner unity, the form of convergence, to borrow from Aristotle, even though we do not understand how this occurs, even though we still do not understand the link between the inner unity and the brain processes occurring simultaneously or in parallel. We are aware of this unity, this sense of unity from time to time, particularly when we feel at home in our body and ourselves, where the sense of who we are takes residence and gives us a firmer sense of identity. For this reason, one might talk of a human being providing a home for the soul. But the sense of unity is an elusive experience, difficult to tie down, capable of fleeing from us. It is in part linked to the unified stream of consciousness, but at least since Freud, we know that consciousness is only a fraction of the soul's activity, and indeed of the brain's activity. Traditionally, one could sense this inner unity when looking into a man's eyes, the eyes being the mirror of the soul. I suggest, and I describe this in the book, that from the experience of death, what is essentially human, the link with others, is revealed by the nature of the fading gaze and dies with the body. I suggest that from a psychological point of view, we call that which links with others the human soul. And we can see that disappear at death. The live gaze, that which reflects back to the other, reveals the essence of a man, their character or a woman, their depth, their value, the weight of their soul, to use a rather medieval image. I've described at various points in the text the experience of contemplating a Rembrandt self-portrait, particularly the one in the National Gallery, the last one of his, in order to grasp the essence of the human soul trying to communicate to another soul. I've described how Rembrandt's eyes seem to take you into the picture, into the depths. But unlike a mirror which reflects your own image back to you, the Rembrandt urges you to reflect into yourself in the act of being drawn into his image. Repeated visits are like drawing from some primal source of light and intensity, leaving you changed in some way, transformed, both uplifted and more melancholy, like, in fact, Rembrandt himself appears to be. Repeated visits do not exhaust the depths of the experience. In this sense, the portrait is always more than it appears. Perhaps here one is touching what religious thought would see as the sacred element of the soul, certainly what Rowan Williams talks about, that sense of things being more than they are. Finally, perhaps music, and I mentioned this at the end of the book, is a more appropriate medium to capture what I've been trying to convey. Proust connects the sense of otherworldliness with music. Perhaps he alone of writers is capable of grasping the essence of music in words. As he put it in his novel, during the break, and this is the scene, a break in a concert, people are talking, and in a passage which provides a suitable place to end, he writes this. But what was I to make of their words, which like all spoken words seem so meaningless, in comparison with a heavenly musical phrase that has just been occupying me? I was really like an angel fallen from the delights of paradise into the most insignificant reality. And just as certain creatures are the last examples of a form of life which nature has abandoned, I wonder whether music were not the sole example of the form which might have served, had language, the forms of words, the possibility of analyzing ideas never being invented, for the communication of souls. Okay, thank you. That's my.
Thank you very much, Roger. Okay, I'm going to start open the dialogue with a few questions, but I'm also looking forward to turning over to everyone else very soon. I want to start by asking you about one of the many key voices in the book, the voice of Winnicott, who obviously has been a presence in your work and your thinking for a long time. Really, I want to ask you about one of the titles of one of his books, in fact, and one that you cite, and that Winnicott, of course, steals from J.S. Eliot, the phrase, home is where we start from. In a way, I'd just like you to gloss that a bit, because in some one of the things that's most striking about the book, reading across it, your book, I mean, is that home acquires an increasing sense, I think, of precariousness, of hard-wonness. In other words, it's almost not assumed that one starts from home, that home is something one can have in the first place to lose. In a sense, home is something that you fight to achieve for yourself, and that one could understand the task of psychic development in those terms. So what do you think Winnicott, after Eliot, means by home is where we start from?
Well, first of all, I mean, I agree the sense of home. I suppose what I was trying to do and what became clear as I started writing it was how complex a notion it is. It isn't, you know, we all assume we know what it is. But it has so many different elements. And I'll come to Winnicott, but part of my work, I think, with so many disturbed families, when I was running the family unit at the castle for 30 years, you know, you saw the bricks and mortar of the ordinary family home had simply fallen to pieces and had to be reconstructed in some way. So I think that was a powerful influence. Now, of course, Winnicott quotes for the Eliot phrase from East Coker, home is where we start from, and that's the title of one of his books. I don't know if he actually wrote that book or whether it was a collection that somebody put together.
Yeah, it might have been, yeah.
I think so, yeah. Obviously, Winnicott's fundamental, and the fact that he, first of all, in many ways, one, his style of open-endedness, and which can be infuriating for people, you know, because his style is not easy. It seems to be quite straightforward, but it isn't. And it kind of goes strange places. And those were the days when you could write analytic papers and get them published in the international journal like that. Those days, unfortunately, are far gone. You have to be scholarly and boring. but, you know, you could just write something that was creative and evocative, and it would get published. And Freud did the same. So first of all, his style that opens up possibilities, you know, not just being reductive, and this is analytic theory, and this is what I'm going to convey. And it comes across in his clinical work. I mean, he could be a little bit lacking in certain boundaries, I think, at times, we know that. But he was so immensely creative, and you could see in the encounter he would allow things to happen and not be too reductive in his interpretations. Indeed, he felt that he'd made one of the greatest mistakes in his life was to make too many interpretations. How many analysts would say that? Mm. They usually say, I haven't made enough. Mm. Or I missed something, I should have said something, rather than I have said too much. Mm. Should be more silence. He does have a very complex analytic theory. I think, you know, that one has to piece it together, I think. I think he finds his own voice around the time of the False Self paper, around that time, mid-late 50s, when he finally detaches from Klein and Klein's influence and feels his own sense of who he is. Mm. And I think somewhere there is a soul concept in Winnicott. He talks about the true self. Mm-hmm. He has a Christian background, very much so. And I think it comes in quite a lot of what he says, and it certainly kind of influenced me. And more specifically, he has certain theoretical ideas about the early development and how a baby has a sense of their body becoming integrated in with the psyche. I mean, there's embodied. I mean, there's quite a complex theory there. Mm.
I want to just push a bit on this idea of the voice, not just the voice in Winnicott, but I'm very struck actually by what you say about how contemporary analytic writing has lost that sense of the grain, what Bach called the grain of the voice in analytic writing. And I think one of the ways in which Winnicott's theory is somehow made to look easy to read, easy to understand, easy to use, is that that voice is actually sort of extricated from it, as though it were an optional add-on, as though it weren't actually part of what he was doing. And I suppose, I mean, I'm interested in that in itself, in relation to Winnicott himself, but also into perhaps one of the problems of contemporary psychoanalysis, which is that, and Adam Phillips has pointed this out, not many people have, but that it's not very interested in its own voice.
Well, I suppose that what's happened, well, maybe has happened, I mean, you have people like Adam Phillips, and you have people writing tedious, worthy analytic papers because of wanting scientific respectability.
Yeah.
So you have, and it's difficult to put the two together, whereas I think earlier on there was a bit more sense of, perhaps because it was new, creativity and aliveness, and not having to have so much respectability.
Do you think that's because psychoanalysis is increasingly looking for criteria outside of itself, of its own development, to legitimize
Could be.
Itself?
Yes. I mean, it's a massive anxiety, isn't it, about its identity, with all the alternative therapies and so on, which I'm not against. I mean, I refer people to CBT if they need it. Short-term work can be very helpful. Not everybody needs or should have psychoanalysis. I mean, it's a very powerful therapeutic tool and process, not for everybody. And some people can use short-term work. But I think because a lot of analysts haven't got maybe the experience of seeing actually how it works, there's an anxiety about what they're doing, an insecurity. And, of course, there's also, less in the UK, but America, a massive problem about getting funding for their work and having to scientifically justify and so on. So then all this, I suppose, adds to the anxiety. It gets away from the area of psychoanalysis of the soul.
Well, what seems such a shame about that is that Winnicott's work, your own work, is not lacking in precision or rigor. So it's not as though we're saying, we would like to be less scientific, just that we would want, and this is, I think, the soul of Freud, we want a more generous, more expansive conception of what it means to be scientific.
Oh, indeed. I mean, obviously, these days, in the public, a massive interest in neuroscience. I mean, I'm also, interested. I did physiology when I was a young man under people like A.F. Huxley and Bernard Katz. Bernard Katz was terrifying, actually, but Andrew Huxley was delightful. He was my tutor. He was a wonderful man. Mm. The only man I ever seen who was faster than the computer of the time. It was unbelievable. And but then, working on microelectrodes with tiny little, to record tiny potentials in the nerve muscle junction, it was just to get that was so difficult. And so I've always been interested, fascinated in neuroscience. But I mean, it's become another kind of, it's become very fashionable as well, hasn't it? Everything must be in the brain.
Yeah.
And I've tried in the book to say, well, of course it's important. Actually, one of the things I said, it's very important if you're looking at a Rembrandt portrait and you have a stroke, it's important that you understand the brain. And somebody, that's very important. I'll try to say that we still don't know about how we get from the heart problem from what a nerve impulse is to a human feeling. There's still people skirt around it the whole time, and we still don't know. And it's fascinating, but the idea that the answer is all there in neuroscience, and to my mind, is absurd. There's human values, human interactions that are vital, trying to understand who we are.
Mm. It seems to have something to do with a kind of indifference now of science to its own philosophical premises. So it can make the leap from observing and describing brain function to making hypotheses about human consciousness or human nature, so that you can find sort of the seat of musicality or ethicality or optimism or whatever it is somewhere in the brain.
Yeah, this is the part is Descartes' search, you know, the pineal gland, and it's what Mary Midgley calls nothing buttery. She's just written this book. Have you seen it just come out? About what are we? Are we just an illusion? Which is interesting. I was just struck. I mean, one of the reasons that led to this book, but I mean, various influences, including Nick Humphreys here, his book on soul dust, which I thought was a fascinating book, and that's one of the many things that maybe want to put down into another book, various thoughts. But there were several key experiences, really. One being on the, going to the clinic and on the Waterloo train, and, when I saw two boys texting each other, virtually sitting next to each other, I thought, what have we come to? You know, really, I mean, can't they just talk? So, and then, you know, if you go back particularly in the early evening on the Waterloo to the line I could take to Twickenham, Reading or Windsor or whatever, you know, everybody's all on their the odd Kindle is fair enough, but I mean, it's all I think, you know, we come so out of touch with ordinary life. So was that. I like going to the National Gallery just to see a few pictures at a time, and it was what struck me about the Rembrandt, you know, that sense of what I've described, and that's a mystery that he seems to capture in the paint. And you see something, whatever you call it, about Rembrandt, his soul, his life, his spirit. It's just amazing that, and he looked so melancholy as well. Of course, he had by then a very troubled life, but it's all in the paint. It's all in that material paint. It's fascinating. And then the other thing was death, and seeing eventually both my parents die and being there, very elderly, and it reminded me of when I was a young doctor. And seeing many deaths, you know, if you work in medicine, much of it is geriatric, and particularly in those days, maybe that, well, any days, a lot of, I saw a lot of deaths, and then seeing it with my parents, and what is it that dies, you know? I mean, of course, if you're religious, you know, you can see, you can understand why religious people think there is a soul, an immortal soul that flies off. You can see something go, the light goes. Gradually, you know, you can see that is a brain function, of course. The brain switches off, but also it's the gaze that goes. And something seems to leave. And it is very powerful. I mean, obviously, if it's a loved one. I mean, the pulses go, the brain switched off, but attachment goes, the feelings go, the emotions go, and the gaze goes. And those seem to me such powerful experiences that needed to, you know, that universal that one needs to try and capture. And that took analytic work, psycholytic work, where one has the care of people's souls.
Yeah.
You know, whatever it is, that's what's so wonderful and powerful and fascinating about being an analyst. Someone's led into, was able, you know, privileged to enter into some way, into another person's world, different cultures, different experiences, some horrendous, some not. And it is such a privilege.
There's somewhere sort of latent in what you've just said is this diptych of this very powerful, you don't shy of the word spiritual, a kind of spiritual experience of otherness and the otherness of the self, in the Rembrandt portraits or in the image of the dying loved one. And on the other hand, this image of the two boys texting. And for me, that forms a kind of diptych. And that we both know that there are professional colleagues within and without psychoanalysis who, listening to you just now, would say, oh, come on, Roger, you're coming over all mystical and mumbo-jumbo-like. Is there a... I mean, not me, but is there a sense in which psychoanalysis, in its insistence on the human being's access to itself, its otherness to itself, is just running against the grain of the culture represented by those two kids?
In some ways, and it always has, isn't it? There has always been radical. And
but can it understand it? Can it understand those two boys, do you think?
Yes, I think so. One doesn't want to pathologize them, because, I mean, you know, I mean, and what would we be without mobiles? My God, what was the world like before a mobile phone? Mm. I just can't, you know, and especially one you could do emails on. My life would be impossible without, you know, especially now I'm no longer in the NHS and having to run my own business. It would just be a complete nightmare. So it's great. It's just people don't seem to be aware of what they're also losing. Mm. I feel somehow. Mm. In terms of mumbo jumbo, I mean, I don't care. Shit, frankly. The thing is, you know, you reach a certain age. The fact is, I'm afraid, you know, it just hits you. Mm. You can't. It's a developmental stage, probably. You know, you hit around 60 plus, and things like this start hitting you, and you just have to think about them. You know. However, I mean, I try. You know, I like to be with young people. I don't like to be with a lot of people my age, really. I like to be surrounded as far as possible with younger people. But you can't help but think of these things, I think, you know. Yeah. And it's inescapable.
Well, one more question and I'll turn over. But it seems to me the emphasis in the book is very much on what Kip Burles would call the non-repressed unconscious. To flesh that out for a second, is not the unconscious of repressed impulses and drives, but the unconscious we absorb from the kind of the language and gestures of those who care for us from the earliest times. That I think is where you're locating a notion of home. And I just wonder, in a way, whether there's a place in what you're calling a psychic home for the more classical repressed unconscious, for sex, for destructiveness.
Yes, no, I mean, I can't put it all together, you know, put everything in.
No, of course.
It's
why I'm asking you now.
Sorry?
It's why I'm asking you now.
Yeah. Personally, I actually find classical psychoanalysis quite useful. When you're actually being an analyst and seeing somebody, I think whatever is grist to the mill and whatever to the mill and whatever's helpful, frankly, you don't actually theorize that much. You may do if you get stuck or if you have to write about things, but obviously sexuality is absolutely vital. And the repressed. I mean, I certainly. But I've tried to get away from classical metapsychology, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, maybe I could try and integrate that more. And if I did, I'd probably get it published in the International Journal. Yeah. But it won't be because I haven't. I think I could. There should be a place for it. But I find it difficult to know quite how to formulate it at the moment. Mm. Maybe you could help me.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can help him, but you may have other questions that you want to ask. So I'm going to turn it over to you to address really anything you like around Roger's work, thinking, discussion this evening.